Good morning, Prince George. By golly, what a glorious day for curmudgeons. This is my 16th program as Uncle Don on Uncle Don Reads the Comics. On CFUR, campus-based community radio at 88.7 FM. We are booming out to the further reaches of downtown Prince George at almost 5 watts. You can hear all the way to CNC when the weather is right. And by the way, hello to CNC listeners today. If you want a comparison, that's less wattage than the bulb that your landlord uses in the hallway. But it works, within kite flying distance. Within kite flying distance of the campus. An apology. I want to begin this show with a correction of something I've been saying for a few months now. Cherish it. I don't apologize often. I've been modestly calling this station Canada's favorite university radio, not because I really believe this assertion, but because it fits the call letters. This station is not, in fact, a university property, although our spacious studios have been allocated by the University of Northern British Columbia. This is a community project run by a non-profit society as a community radio station. We're hoping to reach out and recruit more volunteers from Prince George to come up here and get involved. We already have some participation from students and others at the College of New Caledonia, and I hope we can get more. You don't need any special talents to work at the station or be on the air. I can testify to that. I would especially enjoy having someone as opinionated as myself take a show so we can compare viewpoints. I assure you that I would be courteous and gracious no matter how wrong-headed and obstinately opinionated you might be if you disagree with me. That is a George Bush-sized lie. Let's make the airways sizzle. Ethics. We're lucky we're not in the States. That country is run by ethically challenged politicians and corporate executives. Ethically challenged is a weasel phrase for thief. It helps avoid lawsuits. Here in Canada, we are, well, Canadians. We're honest, upstanding, peacekeeping, considerate, selfless people. If you believe that, you've not attended enough hockey games. But that's not what I want to talk to you about. I want to talk about ethics. Our provincial government, the one that cannot afford to support our hospitals, schools, and other luxuries, is pushing the International Olympic Committee to select Vancouver and Whistler as the site for the Winter Games in 2010. This two-week extravaganza is supposed to provide a huge economic stimulus that will pay for itself in new jobs, tourism, and economic development. Right, ask a Montrealer who is still paying for their Olympic Games of 1976. Our cash-strapped provincial government has promised the Olympic Committee that it will pay at least $300 million to build the infrastructure required for these 2 weeks of jock contests. This does not include rebuilding the notorious Sea to Sky Highway between North Vancouver and Whistler. Anyone who has driven this road knows that it is a fine road, if a rock slide does not get you or some madman does not run you off the road. A good part of the route is carved into the side of a cliff, and those drivers escaping Vancouver or returning thereto are all in a panic to get off the road as fast as possible. The aforementioned cash-strapped provincial government is proposing to upgrade this stretch of road at an estimated cost of $1 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars. Premier Campbell, in his wisdom, has put one Ted Nebeling, MLA, in charge of the upgrading of this highway. Mr. Nebeling lives in Whistler. He claims to love it. He loves it so much he has property there. According to the Globe and Mail, he has been working for 25 years to amass real estate in Whistler. He now owns a number of residential and commercial properties. Mr. Nebeling claims that there is no conflict of interest and is working to throw $1 billion at this upgrading of a stretch of highway to be used by the wealthy to whiz back and forth between work and play. Incidentally, since taxes have been cut for the class of people who will be using this highway, the money will have to be borrowed at fancy rates of interest. But that's all right, as those same people who got the tax cuts and zoom between Vancouver and Whistler will be buying the bonds that mortgage our future. What goes around comes around, for the rich, too. He says this is just a safety issue. Any appreciation in the value of his real estate is just an inconsequential side effect of his selfless pursuit of safety. I would say here that Mr. Nebeling is ethically challenged on this one. He seems to have only a vague perception as to where his driveways end and the public roads begin. The fact that Gordon Campbell did not yank the responsibility for this highway away from this MLA as soon as his conflict of interest was exposed indicated a certain level of tolerance for personal nest feathering that does not belong in government. Mr. Nebeling is so concerned about public safety, he might look to reopen the recently closed hospitals. Chickens coming home to roost. The The big three American auto companies, Ford, GM, and Daimler Chrysler, have plans to close down three of the largest auto factories in Canada in the near future. Big deal, right? We're out here in beautiful British Columbia and the auto plants are back east. It cannot affect us. Wrong. The auto assembly industry has been a driving force for the whole Canadian economy, and we're all tied into its prosperity. Why do we have these auto plants back east anyway? The auto pact with the states in the 60s was a deal that let these three companies import vehicles into Canada duty-free if there was one manufactured here for each one imported. As long as the tariffs were high, it paid the companies to make enough vehicles here to avoid tariffs by moving a significant part of their manufacturing north. Enter Brian Mulroney and his free trade agreement. Duties were eliminated and the tariff incentive to manufacture here disappeared. We have the advantage now of a low dollar in government Medicare, but that's not enough to offset the pressures on companies to build down south of the border. Union wages in the states are higher than here when the conversion is considered, and down there those companies have to pay the high costs of medical insurance for employees. So they should build up here, right? That is the analysis that economists would suggest, but economics is not a science in spite of what the economists like to pretend. Economic analysis seems mathematical and rational when extracted from reality, but reality includes politics. The location of a huge industry like auto manufacture brings out a lot of politics. In autos, as in every other industry, governments can exercise a range of tools to influence corporations. Without the overt tool of tariffs, there's still jawboning and informal pressure from politicians who have the power to wield those other tools. Politicians can and do give tax breaks and incentives to locate in their districts. These pressures on corporations can add up to enough to overwhelm the Canadian advantages. Add to this new so-called anti-terrorism war that threatens to close the border at any time, and the companies want to have all of their manufacturing on one side of the border. With the new just-in-time inventory management, a delay of a few hours at the border can shut down a huge plant and cost many millions of dollars. The result of all this is that our auto industry and all of the feeder industries here are gradually drying up. The huge investments in existing plants will cause them to operate still in the short term, but as they depreciate, we can expect to see them relocate south of the border. Ford has now decided to close the pickup truck plant in Oakville, Ontario, and move the work to a revamped factory in Dearborn, Michigan. Daimler Chrysler has just announced plans to build a new van plant in the Carolinas or Georgia because of incentives. Read that, bribes, being offered by the southern states to attract auto plants. Daimler Chrysler has stated publicly that it was looking to Ottawa for about $200 million in training, infrastructure, and other assistance to build their plant in Windsor. Before we were saddled with this free trade agreement, companies used to spend their own money to build plants in hopes of making money from a product. Now the citizens are supposed to be grateful and provide the capital where the corporations reap the profits. And no taxes, please, or we will have to move to Mexico or Asia. The whole thing stinks. But in the long run, all of this may be eclipsed by the gradual decline of the big three in market share. There's a boom in the building of plants by the Asian manufacturers in the southern states, thanks to their generosity with public assets. These states also offer a God-fearing non-union labor force. Anti-union legislation is a characteristic of these states. While the big three lose customers, Mazda, Toyota, and Nissan pick them up, and in the final analysis, they make a better product. I will say that as a person who worked one summer in a Ford plant turning out pickup trucks. As long as anything went out the door shiny side up, it was good enough. But that was in the days before the invasion of Asian vehicles. Now I own a Toyota truck that I've had for 16 years. The body's rusting away, but it runs like a watch. No more American vehicles for me. A modest proposal. Whereas I've had a belly full of those idiots who currently profess to be running our provincial government, I've written the following letter to our Prime Minister. 16 September 2002, Prime Minister Jean Chrétien, House of Commons, etc. Dear Mr. Chrétien, you may have noticed that we have a new government here in British Columbia. I assume that you are as embarrassed as we are by that the new government calls itself Liberal. This new government has claimed that government is not fit to run a peanut stand, and they are intent on proving this by the administration of our public properties and programs. The promises made by these politicians while running for office have proven worthless. They are dismantling our provincial government and claiming they have no responsibility for the welfare of our citizens. The BC Liberals have abandoned public parks, broken labor contracts, closed schools and hospitals, flaunted international standards for prisons, and announced plans to sell or give away our most precious crown corporations. They're abolishing the regulations and laws that protect our people from the powerful. They have robbed the young, the old, and everyone in between who is not blessed with riches. They are, though, taking good care of the rich by cutting their taxes. If it were not for the public roads, the rich would not need the government at all. And they're working on that, too, by creating private roads. The catalog of their crimes seems endless and expands daily. I see no limit to the plans for their depredations of our fair land. We're at their mercy as they run roughshod over our people. Since the majority of citizens of British Columbia feel abandoned and betrayed by their government, I urge you to complete the job begun by these liberals. There must be a way, constitutional or legislative, that you can abolish our provincial government, transforming our land into a federal territory. We'd all be better off if these liberals were returned to their previous private sector while our land was governed from Ottawa. We would all relish our transformation to citizens of Canada from our present status as victims of British Columbia. Sincerely yours, etc., etc. I've signed this letter with my working alias and dispatched it to the man who promised to eliminate the GST and renegotiate the NAFTA. Hey, nobody's perfect. And where should I go? To the UN? Kofi Annan is a piece of work, too. Weapons of mass destruction. We've finally found that what the developments are in Iraq that have the United States so scared. Saddam Hussein's scientists have made a breakthrough in research on finding an antidote to testosterone. Word has come from Iraq that small amounts of this so-called Agent Pink have been synthesized and are now undergoing extensive tests to determine effectiveness, side effects, and possible methods of dispersal. George Bush's regime fears that the Iraqis are working on producing the new product in large quantities, which might be delivered to the American population centers via aerosols. This appears to be the reason that the Arabs were so interested in crop dusting airplanes. An alternative delivery method might be through the water supplies or, I am told, through foods or beverages. We have reports that security alerts have been raised to code orange at all breweries in the United States and that all imported beers will undergo testing before distribution is allowed. Bush calculates that Agent Pink in the beer supply would kill his administration deader than the dodo. Several think tanks have been looking at this threat and have come up with some projections of the short-term effects that widespread application of Agent Pink would cause. The Republican Party would become as moribund as the Socreds overnight. Widespread military desertions would be likely. Road rage would be an historical curiosity. The long-term effects are totally unknown, but life among any affected population would never be the same. Economic consequences of Agent Pink fear are already being felt. Smith & Wesson stock has fallen 25% since the first rumors began. Defense stocks are in free fall, and General Motors is now offering minus 2% financing on its muscle cars. On the other hand, Martha Stewart Enterprises stocks have recovered all of their recent losses and were trading this morning at a record price-earnings ratio. The kicker in this news is the potential of a blowback effect of any large-scale dispersal of Agent Pink. If this product should spread back to Iraq, Saddam Hussein might find that his Republican guards have stacked their arms and returned to farming. You heard it first from Uncle Don on CFUR, campus-based community radio at 88.7 in Prince George. Truth in language. The world lost a good politician when Astusi Nimi became chairman of Toyota Motor Canada. Who but a born politician could stand up and say something like, Toyota believes strongly that it should build vehicles where it assembles them. With a strong company policy like that, how can Toyota go wrong? Truth. I've been doing a slow boil over the trial balloon being floated by the federal government that they may have to increase the 10%, supposedly to fund Medicare. If this comes to pass, I predict that in 10 years we will have no Medicare, but we will damn sure have that GST surtax. Taxes are only ever rolled back for the rich, and the GST is certainly not aimed at the rich. So I figure I will take off to someplace warm like Tucson, where a friend has a house on the edge of the desert. There she spends her retirement time stomping scorpions and shooting rattlesnakes. I see from the paper that for only $268 I can get to Tucson and back from Vancouver. So I go to the bank, take out $268 and buy my ticket from Alaska Airlines, right? But wait, there is fine print in the ad. It says, see additional rules below. Uh-oh. I have to buy 7 days in advance. No problem. I must purchase tickets within 2 days from now. I must complete the trip by the 18th of December. And there are blackout dates. Minimum stay 2 nights. Why do they care how long I stay there? Maybe I just want to buy a paper and come back. Well, okay. Here we are. Not included in fares shown. GST up to $34. NAVCAN surcharge $15. U.S. transportation tax $42. Vancouver Air Improvement fee $10. Canada security fee of $12. U.S. immigration fee of $11. U.S. security fee of up to $18. And U.S. airport fees of up to $28. All this, and I would have to smell the feet of all the other passengers as they kick off their footgear and search for bombs. Is there anyone out there driving to Tucson who could give me a lift? Here we are, that man yet again. Good Lord, here he is again, looking out from yet another photo in the newspaper, looking like the FAS poster boy for 2002. George Bush is still with us. We are seeing a growing tide of criticism of George Bush around the world, both inside and outside of the United States. I've been part of this tide since it was a trickle, but I want no special credit or recognition. I have a gut reaction to family dynasties, whether they are Kennedys, Bushes, or Windsors. George is pulling out all the stops and trying to rally support in the face of this tide. There's an election coming down in the States, and George is afraid of losing his majority in Congress. He is again using the proven tactic of taking the United States to war and waving the bloody shirt, as they used to say. He's in serious trouble with this war on terror. Some of his strongest supporters are beginning to ask, where's the beef? A year ago, he launched a crusade, a program, of finding one Osama bin Laden, the renegade member of the wealthy bin Laden family that has done business with the Bush family in the past. There we go, another bloody family dynasty. Whatever the actual motivation, the United States military launched a bloody search of Afghanistan where bin Laden was reputed to have been receiving his mail general delivery. After a few months of bombing and invasion, they achieved their goal, overthrowing the Taliban. But wait, where did that goal come from? I thought they were after bin Laden. Never mind, in the current parlance, they moved the goalposts. If you cannot achieve your primary goal, select a secondary one that you have achieved and declare victory. Even the American people are beginning to see through that one. But George is still losing support. He is finding that you cannot keep the adrenaline flowing for a year without people becoming bored and returning to their normal concerns. With all of the intrusive activities by the security forces and the interruption of lives, the best they can come up with is some klutz with explosive shoes. And the security apparatus didn't catch that one. Airline passengers did. Nice job. The latest ploy of George was to declare that the threats had heightened on the anniversary of the stunt last September. Funny thing is, one characteristic of those stunts was that they were not preceded by threats. But never mind, Bush has found some grainy videotapes that prove, well, something. In response to amorphous threats, George declared that the United States security was notched up to Code Orange. I don't know if that scares the terrorists lurking out there, but it has upset a lot of little old ladies in Minnesota. This heightened security has meant that shipborne containers now have a 3% chance of being searched instead of the former 1%. Now those little old ladies can sleep peacefully. The American president, who I suppose can now be called Agent Orange, is pulling out all the stops in trying to derail personal criticism. It has come to my attention that George has applied to the District of Columbia for special parking privileges based on the claim that he is morally handicapped. They will never be able to deny that one. Now he will be able to hide behind legislation preventing discrimination against the handicapped, and I expect that we can see him waving his little blue wheelchair tag when appealing for sympathy. While I am talking about Bush, I've been struggling to discern an historical analogy for George Bush, the George Bush Jr. regime. Where does little George think he fits into the flow of history? Maybe he thinks he can complete the unfinished work of his father. It is easy to see him as a cat's paw for his father, who is taking a second shot at the presidency. He was certainly resurrected many of the discredited cabinet members who served his father, but even his father showed more sense than to wage war indiscriminately in the face of world opinion. Maybe George envies the regime of Lyndon Johnson, famous for his administration of bombs, bullets, and bullshit, as critics of the time characterized it. But Lyndon had his war on poverty, while George just has a war on the poor. Maybe he is itching to emulate Harry Truman and use some of those 30,000 nuclear weapons that have been gathering dust. But Truman oversaw the rebuilding of Western Europe, while George is just a destroyer. I suspect that he sees himself as another John Kennedy as he faced Nikita Khrushchev over the crisis sparked by Russian missiles in Cuba. Here stands the heroic Bush, eyeball to eyeball with the madman Saddam Hussein, protecting the world from Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. This may be the mental image that brings a smile to the face of one with a shallow intellect like Bush, but the analogy is just as shallow. John Kennedy was dealing with the Soviet Union, a country that was armed with weapons that had the potential to turn the United States into a wasteland. Saddam Hussein has come through a dozen years of embargo and forced disarmament. According to Scott Ritter, Iraq is 95% disarmed and has no weapons of mass destruction. Scott is no lightweight. Scott Ritter is an American with a history of 12 years in the Marine Corps with service in the first war against Iraq. Then he was a UN weapons inspector in Iraq. He should know. The thing that Bush has in common with Kennedy is his total disregard for the consequences of his personalized confrontation. Kennedy was ready to destroy all human life. Bush is ready to kill hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and destabilize the balance of power in the world. There's nothing heroic in pushing Iraq around. It is just bullying. I believe that George Bush, the younger, will go down in history as the most despicable coward ever to have stolen the office of President of the United States. As a creep, he outshines even Richard Nixon. At the risk of exposing my personal bias, I don't like George Bush. Kennedy. During the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis, which the Cubans just called the October Crisis, we stood on the brink of nuclear war. Kennedy pushed Khrushchev on an issue that was blown out of proportion. The Soviets were placing intermediate-range nuclear missiles on Cuban bases just 150 kilometers from Florida. I could have supported this arrangement if their range were not over 500 kilometers, but no one asked me. I did not like Florida any more then than I do now. Kennedy reacted with righteous indignation at the placing of missiles so close to American targets, but he totally ignored the fact that the Soviet Union was ringed by American nuclear missiles, some of which in Turkey were just tens of kilometers from Soviet territory. The Cuban-based missiles were small potatoes, but Kennedy was apparently ready to send all of those American missiles off to back up his demand that the Soviet missiles be removed from Cuba. We all owe our lives to the fact that Khrushchev realized Kennedy was ready to push the button and he backed down, removing the offending missiles. I've no respect for Kennedy for his rolling the dice on this one. I was in New York City during those dark days of October 1962, and everyone was damned scared. This was not like the recent stunt there where a couple of buildings were knocked down. We were all in the potential ground zero on this one, and we were quite aware that some of the giant Russian SS missiles were aimed straight at us and 30 minutes away. Prince George. Nobody ever came to Prince George to stay. I'll say that again. Nobody ever came to Prince George to stay. This city is filled with people who came here for 2 years, max, to make a nest egg and go off to somewhere else. I came here that way in 1975, as did everyone I have known here since then. I did not come for the snow or the pulp mills. I did not come for the black flies and the mosquitoes. I came because I was offered a job. I had a job in Oakland, California, that had a future if I wanted one. I had a reasonable place to live, some good friends. Things were pretty soft, and I was on a roll. But I was in my mid-30s, a time when I wasn't quite young anymore, but I had a way to go before becoming old. I was becoming aware that I was on a track to becoming what I had seen a lot of other people I knew had become, a boring, aging fart. Whether subsequent events made me avoid this fate is a matter of opinion. California was even then becoming overcrowded and crime-ridden. People were becoming nasty, like too many rats in a cage. Then, one day at work, the phone rang. It was a man I had worked with some years before who immigrated to Canada because he had two small sons who did not want to become soldiers. He offered me a job in Prince George, doing pretty much what I was doing in California. I said, "I'll take it. Where in hell is Prince George?" This was September 1974. That afternoon, I left work early, drove to San Francisco to the Canadian consulate, and picked up immigration papers. In January, I was accepted. I drove to Prince George after giving away everything that would not fit in or on my Volkswagen. I've been here almost all of the time since. The town I came to was cold and the days were short. I found myself in a furnished basement room on 2nd Avenue with my cat, who had also officially immigrated. That cat never forgave me for leaving California. I looked for some way to make friends away from work, and I tried volunteering to be a roustabout for the theater workshop for a while. But the theater was not right for me. Then I tried the crisis center, and there I found a fascinating crew of screwballs who were trying to do something good while having a good time. I soon found some steadfast friends, and the city began to look a bit more benign. Yes, there were intolerable rednecks, but interspersed with them were some good people. There still are the rednecks, but I feel they've been outnumbered by the more open types, especially those attracted by the university. The building of this place and the upgrading of the College of New Caledonia have given this town a focus beyond making toilet paper and 2x4s. For years, I was thinking about retirement in a university town, and this university was built just in time. I may bitch about Prince George and its blockhead politicians, but it is home, BC liberals and all. It is home. This is CFUR 88.7, campus-based community radio in Prince George. Reality check. Before I get mushy, I feel like attacking something and bringing back the old spirit. How about George Bush? Good Lord, what can I say about that guy? He's off on a tear to destroy Iraq and make the world safe for what? For George Bush. Rumor has it that George is not circumcised, since there seems to be no end to that prick. Then there are the BC liberals. When they finish dismantling the government, I hope they turn out the lights. I have no fear. With the government gone, we will have the corporations to take care of us, if any of the executives are still out of jail, and if they are not all bankrupt. We still have our beloved federal government with its institutions, like the permanent battle between Quebec and the rest of the country, between Chrétien and Martin, between the rich and the poor, and on and on. When I am in total despair for my adopted country, I sometimes cast my eyes afar to a land like India, home to about 1 billion people, saddled with 6 official languages, cursed with hundreds of insoluble problems. It lumbers on. If they can do it, anyone can, and no Mulroney or Chrétien can thwart us. But then, India is only bordered by Pakistan and China, not the United States of America. Is Australia still taking immigrants? Happy bullets. Here's a bit from the Globe and Mail that cries out for comment. Quote, "It can cost as much as 98 cents U.S. a bullet to clean up the ammunition expended at U.S. Army training sites. Lead is an environmental hazard," reports Parade magazine. "The Army is restricting live fire training for soldiers and is introducing a new green bullet that substitutes tungsten for lead," unquote. Where can I go with this? The Army is looking for brownie points with Greenpeace by substituting tungsten trash for lead litter on its multiple training bases. If the U.S. military had a similar concern for its environmental damage around the rest of the planet, they would not be spreading cluster bomblets around Afghanistan for civilians to find, nor would they still be laying landmines that will maim and kill people for decades. They would stop spreading nuclear waste in the form of so-called depleted uranium in Iraq and God knows where else. Maybe they would even stop destroying villages in Afghanistan while wiping out wedding parties. No, I cannot applaud the elimination of a few rounds of lead from bases when such mayhem is caused abroad. Economics Today. At the risk of shocking someone out there, I have an admission to make. I'm a cynical old bastard. I was not always this way. I used to be younger. When I hear all of the commentators saying how the economy is booming and that the stock market can go nowhere but up, my urge is to sell short. I'm not alone in my cynicism. In the past few weeks, every time Son of a Bush has opened his mouth to reassure speculators, the markets drop precipitously. A little knowledge is dangerous, but not as dangerous as no knowledge at all. I know a few things that add up to make me negative about the economy. In those go-go years when stock markets were rising rapidly and steadily, a good number of people who were lucky enough to have cash to invest, as well as those foolish enough to borrow money to invest, were making huge gains on paper. An investment of a few thousand dollars in some shrewd investment like BRIEX, Enron, Nortel, or Global Crossing saw the value of their investments multiply. So from a few thousand dollars, we had people with 100,000 on paper. Did people cash it in? Not likely. If you like 100,000, you will love 200,000. But they acted like they had cashed it in and soon had a bigger house, a fancy car, and splashy holidays. They may even have had borrowed against these paper gains to finance this higher lifestyle. Enter the rapid deflation of stock prices. Now the speculator, if he is lucky, is back a few thousand dollars. But he still has the debts from his high lifestyle and, if he is lucky, a job. So he pulls in his horns. No new car, no expensive university for the kiddies, no vacation. Multiply this by hundreds of thousands of people across the continent who have had the same experience. Buying slows. The people who produce and distribute the goods are hit by layoffs. Businesses cease investing in a falling economy, and everything goes into a tailspin. When I was studying economics, we were enthralled to John Maynard Keynes, the man who helped end the last depression. He said that in a situation where people are cutting spending and demand for everything is dropping, it is time for the government to step in and spend while borrowing money to do so. By cutting taxes and increasing spending on roads, public buildings, sewers, and such, the economy could be jump-started. With the advent of Ronald Reagan, Keynes was forgotten, and the monetarists who believe that the economy can be manipulated by interest rates only came into power. Since then, we are back to the policies of Herbert Hoover, the American president who deepened the Great Depression by balancing the U.S. budget when a surplus was needed. It did not work then, and it will not work now. It remains to be seen whether Bush can pull this country out of recession with military spending while cutting back on pumping money into the areas of the economy where it'll work its way upward, creating jobs and opportunity. Stay tuned. This is the end of Uncle Don's rant for Wednesday, 25 December 2002 on CFUR Radio. This is coming to you on FM at 88.7 or 101.5 on cable. Stay tuned for exciting programming. I guess that will take care of the little bastards for another week.